And it is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. We have an interesting program this hour. We welcome Dr. Carl Hart. He's a Miami guy with Carroll City roots. He's also a neuroscience professor at Columbia University and a researcher in neuropharmacology. He's written the book, High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Welcome to you, Dr. Carl Hart. Good to meet you.
Thank you for having me. I am so excited to be here.
Back home. Welcome, Dr. Hart. Have you taken a risk in writing this book, given your position at Columbia and your mostly unorthodox views on drugs?
Some people may say that I've taken a risk, but it doesn't really feel like a risk because my grant funding may suffer as a result. But I think that the potential benefits of writing this book for society at large far outweigh the minor risk that I take.
You've been called a scientific rock star. Is that accurate?
Well, that's new, Joe, man. I hadn't heard that one before.
It was in some of your press material.
Oh, well, I guess I need to read my press material.
Well, are crack cocaine and methamphetamine more dangerous and addictive than other drugs? Most people would say yes.
Well, the first thing I want to say, I'd like to preface all of my remarks here today, is that whatever we talk about, it's not to encourage people to engage in any illegal activity, including drug use.
Of course.
Now, about your question, when we think about is crack cocaine, methamphetamine, those things more dangerous than other drugs? Certainly drugs can be dangerous, but when we think about relative danger, if we think about, for example, withdrawing from drugs, we've seen in the movies how heroin addicts look like they're going to die, and it looks like they're in
shakes, chills.
They're in excruciating pain. Now, you can't die from heroin withdrawal, although in the movies it's portrayed as if it's next to death, but it's really like the flu. If you had the flu, you've had heroin withdrawal. Now, the only drug that you can die from is alcohol withdrawal, the one that we're all familiar with. That's the one that we really are concerned about. Methamphetamine withdrawal, you can't die from. Cocaine withdrawal, you can't die from. And so when we start thinking about dangers, we have to talk about what effect are we talking about. If you have cardiovascular illnesses and you're taking methamphetamine, for example, probably not a good idea. Probably can cause some potential harm that may lead to death, because methamphetamine is really good at increasing.
But you see people that look like scarecrows and they've lost their teeth and.
Well, you've been watching too many movies, man.
Really?
That's not reality. The reality is that, yeah, there are people who use drugs who look bad. They certainly can, but they look bad before drugs and they'll probably look bad without drugs. That's number one. The vast majority of people who use drugs don't. They look like you and me, and you are handsome as hell. So, not like what has been portrayed in the movies.
I had no idea before seeing the diagram in your book that crack cocaine and powder cocaine are the same drug. So, why is the perception so different from the truth and the penalty so much harsher for one than the other?
Well, we have to go back to the mid-1980s when the country first became acquainted with crack cocaine. When we first became aware of crack cocaine, it was associated in the media with people in the city, primarily black folks in the city, and it was associated with horrible sort of behaviors. When you have new drug markets, typically there are fights for those markets, and there is some violence, and there are some deaths, and that certainly happened with crack cocaine. But it was overblown and overstated with crack cocaine. And so we thought as a country that this was so horrible, we had to do something. And this was new. This was a brand new drug, we all thought. But it wasn't true. The difference between crack cocaine and powder cocaine is simply this. Powder cocaine has a hydrochloride salt attached to it, whereas crack cocaine does not. If you take out the salt, you can simply by adding baking soda, you can take out the salt, that hydrochloride salt. If you do that, now you can smoke the drug, whereas with powder cocaine hydrochloride, you can't smoke it.
I see.
And that's the only difference. And the hydrochloride portion doesn't add to the behavioral or the pharmacological effects of the drug.
So why is the penalty so much harsher for one than the other?
The penalty is so much harsher for one and not the other is because the main reason is that we have been taught that crack cocaine was so much more dangerous than powder cocaine, which is not true. All of the scientific evidence now show that. But we accepted this so readily because of all of the media depictions of people who were using crack cocaine, who were selling crack cocaine, crack cocaine babies, all of these things that turned out not to be true is why those penalties were so much harsher.
Mm-hmm. You say that much of what we've learned about drugs were actually researched on animals and at levels that are much higher than any human being would ever take. Tell us about the labs you use and the experiments you do.
So originally, back in 1990, I started out studying animals, laboratory animals. And then after I got my PhD in 1996, I thought that I should learn something about human drug abuse and drugs and the effects in humans. So now what I do as a result is that I bring people into the lab and people who are drug addicts, in some cases people who have drug experience. And we pass all of the ethical requirements, and I bring these folks into the lab and we actually study the real effects of these drugs on behavior, on cognition, on food intake, on social interaction, on sleep, on brain functioning.
fMRIs also?
Yep, fMRIs, brain functioning, a wide range of effects, EEGs, you name it, we study it. And so we know a great deal about what drugs do and what drugs don't do. The problem is that the public doesn't know a great deal because of media, documentary films that exaggerate the effects of drugs. Police officers, law enforcement, they have a lot of bad behavior that they deal with, and it's so easy to attribute this bad behavior to drugs. And if someone says, oh, someone is misbehaving or acting badly, and say, oh, it must be on crack cocaine, it must be on a drug, then we just accept it. And that's a problem, because now we have an unrealistic view of what drugs actually do and don't do.
So they've been largely vilified and demonized in our society. What are we getting wrong?
Oh, we're getting so much wrong about drugs. Let's think about crack cocaine. Let's think about methamphetamine. Let's think about heroin. One thing that we all believe is that the majority of people who use those drugs are addicted. That's simply not true. 80-90% of the people who use those drugs are not addicted. In fact, the guys in the White House, the President Obama, the guy before him, George Bush, the guy before him, Bill Clinton, they all indulged in these illicit drugs as in their youth and so forth. And they went on to make important contributions to the country, and we are grateful. And that's the more typical drug user. The one that we see in the public, however, is an exaggeration. That's one thing. Other things that we get wrong is that we say one hit of crack cocaine, one hit of methamphetamine, you're addicted. One hit of heroin, you can become addicted.
Right.
All of that is just simply not true. Drug addiction requires work.
Well, let's talk a little about addiction. You do the DSM definition from the American Psychiatric Association that it interferes with parenting work or intimate relationships. So are some people just more prone to becoming addicted than others?
Yeah, so when you look at the data and you see that the vast majority of people who use all of these drugs don't have a problem. Now, what that tells you is that it's more than just a drug. It's something else going on. It's beyond pharmacology. And those psychosocial things have not been attended to by us in science, by a number of people. We don't look at those things. Those are the most important things to do. Some of these folks who are addicted to drugs never were responsible individuals. They never learned skills. They never had any education or what have you, a wide range of things. Of course, we can think of the rare person who had a lot of money or skills and that sort of thing, and they still became addicted. That certainly happened, but
right.
That's an aberration. That's an extreme aberration.
Explain the history of dopamine research and addiction. We hear so much about dopamine.
Yeah, so dopamine in the early 1990s, from 1990 to 2000, that was entitled Decade of the Brain. And during the Decade of the Brain, we were really excited about dopamine because we thought that increases in dopamine activity led to pleasure. And it seemed as though all of these drugs, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, they all increased dopamine. So we thought, aha, we got it. This is the
Having a great meal or sex would increase dopamine.
That's right. All of those natural rewards, they would increase dopamine. But drugs were more effective at increasing dopamine. So we thought we had it. Now, as it turned out, years later, more research, it's like stress would increase dopamine. When someone is frightened, that increased dopamine. So dopamine is increased in a wide range of sort of behaviors. It seems to be something like it increases as a result to tell the animal, the human, to pay attention to something, and it's not specific to reward. But yet people seem to believe that even today.
I was interested in the experiment you were doing on human beings or with human beings in the lab. And when you were saying that instead of getting another hit of cocaine, somebody would opt to get the money. Would you tell us more about those implications?
Yeah, so like one of the misconceptions about drug use and drug users is that they were crack cocaine users, for example, they only got it by another hit of drug. And so one of the things that I learned as an undergraduate is that if you give an animal an option between taking something like cocaine, methamphetamine, or something like having a sexually receptive partner, or having a running wheel, or having some sweet treat, they will take those other options rather than take the drug. So I thought it'd be cool to do a study in humans where you provided crack cocaine addicts with options. Would they be only driven to get another hit of crack cocaine if you provided them with an alternative like more money or an alternative like merchandise vouchers or merchandise? What would happen? And what happened, not only in my studies, but a number of other studies, is that cocaine, you can disrupt cocaine taking behavior by simply providing alternatives, competitive alternatives. And so folks will choose those alternatives rather than taking drugs.
So, well, we'll get to, I'm thinking of, instead of imprisonment, maybe there are other ways we can deal with addicts in our society. We're speaking with Dr. Carl Hart. He's neuroscientist and 22 years studying neuropsychopharmacology, associate professor of psychology and psychiatry at Columbia University. Name of the book is High Price. We'll be back on Topical Currents. Stay with us.
Past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. We're speaking with Dr. Carl Hart. We're talking about addiction and the misconceptions that many people have about it. Our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, if you're a little shy, that's radio@WLRN.org. And also tweet.
You can tweet us at Topical Currents. So where we left off, how should we as a society be treating addicts instead of imprisoning them?
One of the things that you will notice from my book, High Price, is that my focus is not on addicts so much. I do talk about addicts, but that's one of the problems that the country has, one of the things that I thought the country direction that the country is going in the wrong way. Only about 10-20% of the people who use these drugs are addicted. But yet, all of the resources, damn near all of the resources, is focused on that pathological minority.
Okay.
I am asking the country to think about the 80-90% of the people who are not addicted.
Like general recreational users.
Like the president before him. That's right, exactly. And so when I think about, to answer your question, how do we handle the folks who are addicted? I think we're doing a pretty good job with that. And I think we're learning quite a bit in terms of treating those folks. They need help, obviously, but it's not just a medical issue, it is a psychosocial issue. So if you think that if you're gonna go to your psychiatrist and solve the problem, that's naive. And that's probably not the most the appropriate approach. It's a psychosocial, pharmacological, a wide range issue. That's one. Now, when we think about public policy should not be focused on the pathological users. Public policy should be focused on the 80-90% of the folks. So our current public policy is to say, you have these drugs, you go to jail for the most part. In some cases, you can go to treatment, even though jail and treatment are not appropriate for most of the people. So I make the case in the book that we should be thinking about other sort of strategies, like decriminalization.
Right. So you're not for legalization of drugs. You're for decriminalization of drugs.
Yeah. I feel like I need to explain to the listeners what's the difference, because I get it from the left and the right. Legalizers want me to say legalization, and the folks on the right say, what are you saying? Legalization is what we do with alcohol, in that if you're 21 and older, you can legally purchase alcohol. It can be sold legally. Under decriminalization, selling is still a criminal offense. However, possession, however, becomes now not a criminal offense. Instead, the equivalent of a parking or a driving violation. And so this way, you deal with these, I think we arrest 1.5 million people in this country every year for drugs, and 80-some-odd percent are for simple possession, and now they get a criminal record. In this way, you prevent those folks from getting a criminal record, and you enhance their ability to make a contribution to the society, just like the president.
Has the 45-year or so war on drugs had any effect on usage?
The 45-year or so war on drugs has not. This is one of the major inappropriate or incorrect assumptions that people make. People make an assumption that that humans will not use drugs. That's ridiculous. Humans have used drugs since we've been here, and they will continue to use drugs. The notion that we can decrease drug use that's already low is ridiculous.
Can today's politicians face this head on because of the political ramifications of the opponent saying, oh, you're soft on drugs, and you're probably soft on crime, and you're not going to be elected?
You might notice from the book, High Price, I don't focus on the politician. I have little faith in politicians. They don't lead, they follow the people. And so the book is aimed towards the people in order to enhance the intellectual tone around discussions about drugs. So in the past, we have had adolescent conversations about drugs. High Price is trying to ask the country to have an adult conversation. Politicians, they will follow the people. They're not going to lead on this issue, because the point that you just made was absolutely right. They were afraid to be seen soft on drugs.
So you say we need to stop having police officers and politicians provide the drug education. Just how important is education, and where can one turn to get it?
Yeah, I'd like to say something about the current approach that we're doing with education. Police officers are providing a large amount of the public education about drugs. They have no training in pharmacology, no training in the behavioral sciences. This is there have been few things that have had more of a harmful effect on public health than that sort of approach. Politicians also know nothing about drugs. When we think about where do you get the appropriate education for drugs, you start with books like High Price. This is, it's written at a level that high schoolers can get. You ask scientists who study humans, not scientists who study laboratory animals exclusively and have no experience with the studies in humans, because they too may misinterpret some of the findings because of the dosing that they use in their studies. They use doses sometimes that are so excessive that they're not relevant to the human condition. Because if you give an animal, like in some of these studies, 10 times the amount that human takes of a drug like acetaminophen, a drug like nicotine, you're going to cause some damage. So why wouldn't you expect that you would cause some damage with cocaine or methamphetamine?
Right.
And so you have to, in the book, I try and explain questions that people can ask of folks who are providing the education to them. Were the studies that you're talking about conducted in humans? If not, were the doses comparable to what humans take? A number of questions that can be asked of the educator.
You know, what's the most surprising misconception that most people have about drugs?
I think the most surprising was that the majority of people who use drugs like crack cocaine are not addicted. Another one is people who use drugs like methamphetamine, for example, are not cognitively impaired, or these drugs don't cause the type of behaviors that are attributed to the drug. I think in Miami about a year and a half ago, you guys had the case in which the guy ate off the other guy's face.
Oh,
right.
Yes.
So when those sorts of cases come around periodically, and we all thought, well, not me, but the public thought that the guy had, he was taking bath salts.
Right.
But when,
that was what they,
that's right,
had said originally.
But when the toxicology, the urine and the blood came back, the only thing that was in his system was marijuana, or the or THC from marijuana.
Which doesn't cause violence.
That's right. And we don't even know when he last had taken marijuana. So it could have been a couple of weeks before. So we don't think that marijuana was a contributing factor there. But people have, they attribute these extreme behaviors to drug use. I have given thousands of doses in the laboratory, crack cocaine, marijuana, methamphetamine, all of these drugs, and have never seen anything remotely resembling what is said in the public about drugs. That's not to say that you can't get bad behavior in drug users, because you certainly can. But that bad behavior is dependent upon the context, the person, a wide range of things.
Well, we need to go to a break in a couple of minutes, but I wanted to talk a little about your childhood and growing up here in South Florida. You came from a pretty rough environment and
a broken family.
Broken family. Tell us a little about that.
Well, in the book, High Price, I certainly talk, it's a personal narrative, it's a science story, and it's a public policy story. I told this deeply personal story because I know the power of anecdote. And I am, but my anecdotal story I told mainly so people could understand that I am not special, I am not unique, and there are some things that our society can do to ensure that we get folks to where I am now, a professor at Columbia. And the society has basically ignored or chosen not to do those things. For example, when I came up, as you described correctly, it was a difficult situation. But there were some safety nets. There was aid to families with dependent children, no longer here, welfare as we once knew it. There were summer programs for kids in situations like mine, where we worked at the age of 14 and older, and we got money during the summer. We were kept off the streets. There was a wide range of sort of programs that helped me to get to the level where I'm at. And we certainly can replicate that today if the society chooses to do so, but we haven't chosen to do so.
You also were in the military, which helped you a lot, you say?
I was
in sports. And
sports was critical. I played basketball at Miramar High all 4 years of high school. In order to be on the basketball team, I had to maintain a C grade point average, and that allowed me to graduate, even though that standard isn't that high, but it ensured that I got a high school diploma. It ensured that I could go into the military. In the military, I had all kinds of mentors. I spent most of my time over in England, and I began to think more critically about our society as a result of being in England. All of those sorts of things contributed to me getting to where I'm at now.
We're speaking to Dr. Carl Hart. And the name of his book is High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Stay with us, and we'll come back and take some calls. And welcome back to Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper and Dr. Carl Hart. He's a neuroscientist and 22 years studying neuropsychopharmacology. Associate professor of psychology and psychiatry at Columbia University. The name of his book is High Price.
Let's take a call or two. We've got Beth in Miami. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Beth.
Oh, hi. I didn't hear the name. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm really curious. This is just the kind of discussion that I love to hear, because I think we are really needing to make some change. And I was curious how you would make that change with the government and the current, the way that people are currently thinking. I think as we get more tests and scans and they prove that certain things are very much physiological, like ADD and OCD, you know, there's so many people who are so anti-medication and who are not wanting to do anything but an organic route that may result in extended suffering. How are we going to get society to believe that certain things can really be a quick route to not only the end of suffering, but also, you know, changes in behavior and the ability to function in society?
Dr. Hart?
Hi, Beth. Thank you for the question. It's not entirely clear to me because I think there were some assumptions made in the question about what we know about things like ADHD and OCD. There is not an agreed upon biological explanation for either of those disorders. And so you, as long as that's the case, you're going to still have these controversy whether or not you should be medicating folks or whether you should be trying behavioral approaches. And I think there still remains too much to be learned before we have some real consensus about.
Well, I would totally agree with you on that. I think, though, that it looks like things are leading that way, and I think it's hard enough to get a consensus, especially with we've got a big drug industry trying to make money with very brief testing and getting drugs approved that don't necessarily have a basis. And then the other side of it is that the kinds of drugs, say sleep drugs, that are so heavily marketed and just given, becoming part of ADA, you know, everyday life, that depressed respiratory.
Doctor, what are your feelings on these television ads for prescription drugs, building up sort of a desire of people to go to their doctors and say, I want to take this brand of drug?
This is relatively new. I think maybe 15 years ago or so, drug companies weren't allowed to promote their drugs directly to the consumer. And that's a concern. That deeply concerns me. Because people are looking for a quick fix.
And then the list of side effects. Whoa.
Well, that goes on for longer than the part of...
Well, one of the things that we have to understand is that no matter what you do, there are side effects. And we try to weigh the risk-benefit ratio such that the benefits outweigh these risks. Because we can all see the example where a kid has seizures so disruptive that they can't... it's debilitating. Now, you give that kid a heavy-duty psychotic drug or a psychoactive drug, and we're concerned about it, but the kid now no longer has these debilitating symptoms, and clearly the parent would be happier. But if a kid is not having these debilitating symptoms and you give them that drug, now we are more concerned. So we have to weigh the risk-benefit ratio on a case-by-case basis. So side effects is just the things that we have to live with.
So the thumbnail of high price is that you certainly recognize there's addiction and it's a problem and can cause tragedy, but it's a very small percentage, and that it's those reactions are shared as though they're universal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the main thesis of high price, is that I am so greatly concerned about our current drug policy being based on some assumptions that are false. And these assumptions are not...
I saw reefer madness in school.
Well, you're living in reefer madness right now. It's just the language is more tempered. The concern is that these assumptions that we make about these drugs are not innocuous. There are whole populations in our society that are impacted negatively, disproportionately, like the whole crack powder thing. Crack cocaine was punished 100 times more harshly than powder. 85% of the people convicted under the crack cocaine laws were black. And even though they were not the majority of the crack users. And that exists throughout our drug policy. Drug policies that are based on false assumptions. And that just requires anybody with a conscience to say something about this.
Let's talk about the racial undertones or overtones or whatever you want to say. Like, I heard one statistic that blacks are 4 times more likely to be arrested for marijuana use than whites, even though the usage is equal.
Yes, that's nationwide. But when we go to various states, for example, if we go to Nebraska, that number goes all the way up to like 8 times more. Minnesota, 8 times more. So it all depends where you're at. But in general, they are 4 times more likely to be arrested. But that's not new. And this is one of my concerns, is that drug policy as it currently is, it's used as a tool to further marginalize black folks and poor people.
Have you ever been targeted?
Yeah, I've been targeted.
Profiled.
I've been profiled, targeted. I've been stopped. I described this in High Price on the National Institutes of Health campus. Mm. You know, as a scientist studying for my PhD, I was pulled aside and asked to be subjected to a one-man lineup for strong-arm robbery. I've been targeted as a potential drug dealer. This is not uncommon for some of us.
Which is one of the things that you address in the book. We have an emailer was wondering if Dr. Hart could comment on an observation made by a Parkinson's researcher at a conference. Researcher said he had never seen Parkinson's in people who indicated they had cocaine and or alcohol habits. He speculated this was a protective factor because both habits produce abundant dopamine, whereas Parkinson's a result of underproduction of dopamine. That's from Arch.
Thank you for that. I mean, one of the things that I learned at school is that people who, actually there are some scientific papers published on this, people who smoke tobacco cigarettes, for example, have a negative relationship with Parkinson's disease. They are less likely to develop Parkinson's disease. And so we have speculated that nicotine or something in tobacco smoke is protective. And since Parkinson's disease is largely a dopaminergic or lack of dopamine disorder, people and nicotine increases dopamine, people have speculated about maybe nicotine's ability to increase dopamine is protecting people. We don't really know. But I think the best amount of data for Parkinson's having an inverse relationship with Parkinson's drug use would be nicotine. In terms of cocaine, I had never heard that one before.
Okay.
Let's take another caller. This is Judith in Miami. Hi, Judith.
Yes, good afternoon. And first of all, Dr. Hart, welcome home.
Thank you.
I'm coming to this issue from the opposite end of the spectrum. I've worked in addiction treatment for many years. So a couple of questions. Number one, you've spent a lot of time in the lab, and as we know, those of us who are in the treatment field, the greatest help that we are receiving now is coming from brain science, is coming from people who are looking at the effect of psychoactive substances on the brain. So question number one is, have you ever worked at all in the clinical treatment area?
Yes, I have. I've worked in a methadone center, providing group therapy, a wide range of sort of things. I just want to ask you something about you're saying what the brain imaging data has provided for you. Quite frankly, brain imaging data has not provided anything for treatment. We have a lot of pretty pictures, but we don't know what it all means yet. So I think we have overstated what we have with brain imaging.
Are those pretty pictures necessary for research funding?
Those pretty pictures are critical for enhancing the research budgets because the folks in Washington they like to see those pictures, and it you can now make the case that drug addiction is a brain disease. And when you do that and you compare it to other brain diseases like Parkinson's disease, like Alzheimer's disease, you can look at the brains of a Parkinsonian patient or a patient with Alzheimer's disease, and you can tell the difference between someone who does not have those disorders. Now, with drugs, you can't look at the brains of anyone who's using drugs and compare it to someone who's not using drugs and tell the difference. That's just, we are not there yet. We don't have that technology.
Well, if I may, that kind of leads to sort of the second question that I wanted to see your point of view. Again, coming from the treatment end, addiction, in my experience of many years, is a horrible, horrible, horrible condition for an individual human being and for everyone who loves that person.
I agree.
So the challenge, I think, when I listen to you, and, you know, psychopharmacology, of course, is also essential, but because I don't think you have a way in your lab, and nobody else has a way in their lab, of determining if a presidential candidate or your two interviewers or you or I are exposed to a psychoactive substance, there's no test at this time to say whether we have the potential for addiction. So if you would agree with that statement, are you in favor of encouraging young people or even older people to experiment with psychoactive substances, given the lack of predictive information regarding addiction?
Okay, let him respond.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I want you to know at the outset we said that this conversation was not to encourage people to engage in any illegal activity, including drug-taking behavior. That's number one. Number two, please understand, I have young kids of my own. I have a 12-year-old and an 18-year-old. And I am deeply concerned about their welfare, of course, as well as other young people's welfare. So that's not, the point is not whether or not I want young kids to use drugs.
It's or that addiction is heartbreaking.
Or addiction is heartbreaking. I agree. Well, no one wants that. But the point here is this. If you take a drug, we know a lot about decreasing the potential harms associated with that drug, and the likelihood of someone becoming addicted, it's really not as high as we all have made it out to be based on the pharmacology of the drug. Addiction is based on a wide range of things, primarily psychosocial things. And we haven't focused on those psychosocial things, like making sure that those kids have alternatives, making sure that those kids are responsible, making sure that those kids have skills. All of these things, if we emphasize these, we certainly can impact the addiction rates, just like we do when we teach kids how to drive a car. Driving in a car can be extremely dangerous, but we don't say, wait a second, it's so dangerous, no one should drive cars. We don't want our kids to drive cars. And no, instead, we teach them how to do it safely. We make sure they wear seat belts. We take a wide range of steps to attenuate, to decrease the likelihood of any sort of harmful effects. The same could be done with drugs without encouraging their use.
We're speaking to Dr. Carl Hart about his book, High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery, The Challenge is Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. One more short break, and we'll be right back.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Wednesday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Carl Hart. Dr. Hart, for your studies in the labs, where do you get your subjects?
We get our subjects by advertising in things like The Village Voice, which is a free newspaper in New York City. Craigslist, everybody knows Craigslist. Word of mouth, people who participated, they have friends, they know folks who might be appropriate. They are subjected to a telephone interview. Then they have some psychiatric screening, medical screening.
Any remuneration?
I'm sorry.
Are they paid at all?
They are paid for their time, and they're paid about equivalent of $10 to $15 an hour.
We have a couple of emailers. I saw a documentary regarding cannabis and how it became illegal. It was made illegal because of racism in the 1930s. This is from Rob. The documentary also had other interesting facts about cannabis. The documentary is The Union.
Yes.
I've seen that.
So when we think about why drugs are illegal in this society, this is also one of the misconceptions. Many people believe that drugs are illegal because of their pharmacological effects. Drugs are illegal primarily in this country because of these social sort of consequences, these social things like marijuana. Marijuana was associated in the 1930s with Mexicans, particularly in Texas, and black people in New Orleans.
And jazz.
And jazz, that's right. Black people in New Orleans, exactly. And as a result, people thought this was a new drug, and it was a new drug associated, because they had never heard of the term marijuana. They'd heard about cannabis, but not marijuana. And as a result of this new drug being associated with these despised already groups, we went after marijuana with some intensity, and the laws changed. The same thing happened with cocaine in the early 1900s. The same thing happened with opium with Chinese folks, cocaine with black people, same sorts of things. That's the reason that these particular drugs are illegal.
Another emailer, John, says you mentioned alcohol withdrawal as potentially more lethal than that of cocaine or heroin. You were interrupted before you can complete the answer. I thought you did complete that. Might you return to this aspect of addiction?
Well, the major point here is that we sometimes don't think of alcohol as being a potentially dangerous drug. It is. And that's not to say that people shouldn't use alcohol, because most people use it safely. But the point is that if we are worried about death from a drug, we should be worried about death from alcohol withdrawal in people who use the drug heavily. Some folks think that heroin overdose, for example, is a major concern. 75% of the people who die from heroin overdose do so because they take in heroin in combination with another sedative, usually marijuana. Heroin overdose alone is rare, but the public believes that the deaths are mainly because of heroin, and that's just bad public health information.
You know, since we're coming close to the end of the program, what social policies, what societal changes do you want to see implemented from your book?
I'd like to see the society move towards decriminalizing all drugs. And as I said, decriminalization is not legalization. Decriminalization is not encouraging drug use. Portugal has decriminalized drugs since 2001. And now we have 12 years of data from that country. And what we see is that they are doing better than us on multiple indicators of drug use. They use drugs less than we do. They have less drug-related deaths. And they are doing better than their European counterparts, or on par with their European counterparts. So the notion that somehow this would lead to more drug dangers and so forth, it's just not supported by the evidence from Portugal and other countries.
What about crime in Portugal? Related, so I guess there isn't drug-related crime.
Drug-related crimes also, they're doing better than we are in this country. On all of the major indicators, Portugal is doing better than us.
Mm-hmm. What about tax implications, too?
Well, with decriminalization, it will be illegal to sell, so there are no benefits from the society in that regard. It's not like legalization where you can legally tax it and legally sell it.
Okay, another quick caller. We are short on time. Don in Miami, hi.
Hi, Joe.
Hey there.
I have a couple of questions for Dr. Hart, but first I'd like to make a comment.
We're short on time. How about one?
Okay, how about I eliminate the comment then and just go to the questions. Isn't one of the roots of the laws criminalizing drug possession religious? In that most religions take a punitive approach to pleasurable behavior not sanctioned by the church, especially Christian and Muslim faiths, which restrict pleasurable behavior to religiously sanctioned institutions, such as sex and marriage. And my second question is, Doctor, have you approached religious leaders about your views regarding decriminalization of drugs?
Well, the first question in terms about the role of religion in restricting drug use, certainly we saw that with alcohol prohibition. Long before 1919, when the United States passed the 18th Amendment that outlawed alcohol, we certainly saw the Christian movement. They were big in with alcohol
Carry
prohibition.
Carrie Nation and all that.
That's right. And that's the first question. And second, have I approached religious leaders? I have not, but I'm in conversation with some, and I will probably be speaking with religious leaders, particularly religious leaders in the Black church.
And how does it feel to be home, Doc?
Man, it's great. I am so happy to be here in the studio with you, Joe, and Bonnie. Thank you all for having me. You all make me want to come back to Miami for good.
That's good. How about those Dolphins?
That's your favorite team.
That's my team, and go Dolphins. I'm still rooting for you, even though I live in New York. Even had a cousin who played. I have a cousin who he played for the Giants. He's now playing with Baltimore, Chris Candy. But I still root for the Dolphins.
Great to have you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carl Hart.
And thanks for listening this hour. Of course, the reason that we're talking about the dolphins there and we couldn't take your calls or emails is because today's program was a rebroadcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction by our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org. And more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page, including links, discussion, and photos. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's program begins with furniture maker Peter Korn. He explores the nature and rewards of craft and other creative arts in his book, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. Also, we have Linda Gassenheimer. She'll visit with Richard Ingram. He's the personal chef of Miami Heat megastar Dwayne Wade. This is Bonnie Berman, and for Joseph Cooper, we wish you a very, very good Wednesday. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay tuned for Here and Now. It's up next from NPR News.